So this is the first integrated report that South Africa has done, and we have been gradually moving towards this integrated reporting in line with best practice internationally. Interestingly, is that we are among the few central banks that do integrated reporting. And actually, Nigeria earlier this year was invited by the European Central Bank to share the South African Reserve Bank experience with integrated reporting. And yet, this was our first integrated report, but it has been picked up all over the world as, oh, here is a central bank that is used. How do we do that? So it's going to be important. The report that has been well received for its ease of accessibility and transparency and defined design and content. Going forward, the bank will be improving on this base and its disclosures in terms of sustainability. The focus areas, capture basically the execution of the bank's mandate, which is price stability, and also the explicit financial stability responsibility that was communicated to us via a letter from the minister, implementation of the 26 regulatory model, a contribution to sound global central banking, enhancing the bank's reputation as a respected partner, and enhancing the organizational effectiveness and efficiency through an investment in people. And lastly, incorporate and more closely align the subsidiaries in a comprehensive group structure. So let me then deal with the economic development, which, as I highlighted, we will just highlight the important one. Important to note that global growth appears to be recovering, but with differing pace of recovery in the advanced economy. The recovery is mixed. The UK has only recently returned to pre-crisis levels of output, and the output for the Japanese economy is also uncertain, while the Eurozone remains well below the pre-crisis level. But there are risks to this outlook. Global growth and contributions from advanced economies show that if this is what are being advanced by some people, that the emerging market economies will decouple from the advanced economies, does not hold. That the emerging market economies are also beginning to slow down at different degrees. And even in the BRICS countries, one BRICS member country, Brazil, has actually already slipped into a recession. So it's not a pretty global picture out there. But then there are also expectations of the U.S. Fed normalization. You'd be aware that the Federal Reserve Bank in the U.S. embarked on unconventional monetary policy to try and take the U.S. economy out of recession. Now, there are indications now that they are moving towards normalizing monetary policy. And what that means is this month is the last month that the Fed will be buying U.S. government bonds. And from there, now we are moving basically towards normalization. They are indicating that they expect that they will start to normalize rates from between 2015 and 2016. And what you see as dots, the economy says, they just refer to them as dots, is what different members of the Federal Open Market Committee, which is the equivalent of the MPC in the U.S., actually see the normalization taking place. So there are two who think that this will take place in 2015, whereas the bulk are either saying 2016 or 2017. So that is what we are hearing from them. But with normalization, emerging market currencies, including the rent, are sensitive to changing expectations of U.S. policy, and that would have an impact on us. And for South Africa, it becomes important because portfolio flows by non-residents have reflected changes in this perception. We have seen that in the period since July, we have experienced net sales of bonds amounting to 31 billion, whilst on the other hand, foreigners continue to buy South African equities. So the pace of normalization in the US has got implications for the South African economy. And with that normalization, we also saw it feeding through into domestic bond yields. Domestic bond yields have been access to global and domestic economic development and have ticked up. As a matter of course, since this talk of normalization commenced, South African bond yields have actually increased by 150 basis points, 1.5%. And what that means is that the cost of government financing is budget deficit, and the cost of the country financing the current account deficit has risen by that amount. On the domestic side, domestic growth remains weak, despite a return to positive growth in the second quarter. The strike in the platinum sector and in the steel and engineering sector only explains a part of it. There are important structural issues that we have got to confront as a country. But even despite the end of the strike, mining output continues to decline. And as we have seen, you would have the time production to come to a standstill. It doesn't follow that once people go back into the mine, that output takes off immediately. It takes time to get the mine into action once again. And the manufacturing sector has also contracted in the first half of the year, which is worrying because this is a very important employer of people, and in particular, low-skilled labor. Real capital formation by the private sector has also registered a contraction for the first time since 2009. And this is a worrying picture because economies grow because there is investment that is taking place. And when you see investment slowing down, what that means is that you are no longer adding to your potential growth in the future. And this could mean that we are in for a tough time going effort. This we have seen in one quarter. We would like to see what happens in the next quarter. The bank at the previous Monetary Policy Committee meeting, we presented our own growth forecast, which for 2014 we see growth at 1.5%. And compare that to last year in November. Last year in November, we thought that the economy will grow by 3%. So we have actually halved our growth forecast from what it was a year ago. And 2015 we expect growth of 2.8% and 2016 3.1%. But the risks to the growth outlook are on the downside, and they would seem to be continuous downward revisions that we have seen so far. With growth in the doldrums, the unemployment rate has continued to fluctuate around the 25% level for some time. And this is the narrow definition of unemployment. If you take the broader definition of unemployment, then we are talking of the 50s. But then what we have seen is that employment in the private sector has not yet recovered to the 2008 level. And what has been driving employment is the public sector. Now, clearly, if employment is purely driven by the public sector, it can't be sustained, especially when you have got a fiscal that is actually facing very tight conditions. And in particular, we see that the mining sector is employing individual people, and it's not just, it's across the subsectors, in mining. What we then see is that it has increased the capital intensity of production. So the graph here, basically what it is showing is that this is what we call the capital labor ratio. So in the period from 2009, you saw the capital labor ratio coming down, which meant that there were more people being employed than machines being employed. And from 2011, you saw that was creeping up. It meant that there is now increased mechanization that is taking place in mining, partly as a result of safety issues, that it is becoming dangerous to send people deep there, but also as a result of the turmoil that we have seen in some subsectors of of mining. Manufacturing, you will see that in that period there, from 2008-2009, you had the capital labor ratio coming down, when we were employing lots and lots of people, but since then it has remained flat, and for the period 2013-2014, you are also seeing mechanization beginning to increase in the manufacturing sector. We have seen a significant number of work days which were lost due to industrial action in the first half of the year. The bulk of this has been in the engineering sector and in the platinum sector. But what that has done is that it has also created a distortion. The strike has resulted in lower wages per worker in quarter one of 2020, as the no work, no pay pulls remuneration down. People are not working. What we measure as the remuneration comes down, and then you saw that adjustment actually taking place during that period. Now, with fewer people employed, people out on strike, growth in household consumption expenditure has been declining steadily. It's a very simple thing. People have not been earning. There is very little for them to spend with. And you saw the pace of household consumption expenditure declining steadily. It comes running because household consumption expenditure makes just over 60% of gross domestic expenditure. And this actually has been reinforced by increasingly subdued credit expansion by banks to households. Very simply, when people do not have the remuneration that they normally pay, they try to supplement this by borrowing. And but then it also happens at the time when the banks, because they can see that people are not working, they tighten the lending standards, and the result was that what we have seen is a decline. The red line there shows you a decline in loans extended to the household. The good news has been that credit continues to be extended to the companies, which is where you actually want the bulk of the credit to be going to. But even still, it has not underpinned gross domestic investment as we had seen. Household debt remains high, but there has been some gradual deleveraging. As a matter of course, actually, we have had household debt as a percentage of domestic disposable income declining from a peak of 83% in the first quarter of 2009 to 73.5% in the second quarter of this year. So what the North African households have done is that they have utilized the fact that you have historically low interest rates to repay their debt, which basically means that household balance sheets are being repaired. But bear in mind, these are gross figures. The household indebtedness at the lower end of the income category is actually still under pressure from the situation. Well, with us not producing as much as we were supposed to, and thus consuming more than what we are producing, it meant that we have got to source the difference of the goods from elsewhere in the world, and that we saw with the deficit on the current account widening again in the second quarter of 2014. The widening of the current account deficit was worrying because it took place despite a depreciated yield exchange rate. When the exchange rate depreciates, it's supposed to spare exports and constrain imports. And because you constrain imports and spare exports, you are expecting that we will be selling more to the rest of the world than we are importing from the rest of the world. But our current account deficit remains wide. Part of it is explained by the fact that we have got an infrastructure program where you have got the bulk of the equipment having to come from offshore. Imports have not responded strongly to the depreciated exchange rate, but actually neither has exports responded to it, which then was also worrying because in 2009-10, the cry from South African exporters was that if the currency depreciates, they would be able to begin exporting. Those exports didn't take place, and the reason why they have not taken place is not hard to find. Price is one thing, the other is whether the global demand for the export is there. If that global demand is not there, it doesn't matter how cheaply you price your export, no one, there would be no change. But the thing for us here is this picture of South African commodity prices. The top line there shows that commodity prices in rand terms have been strong. But they have been strong in rand terms because the currency has depreciated. If you look at the commodity prices in dollar terms in South Africa, they have been on a downward on a downward slope. The South African export volume growth has been weak over time, and basically it's reflecting the fact that we are losing competitiveness. And we say that you can't solve all of those problems just through the exchange rate. Now, with exports being weak and imports strong, that difference has to be financed. That current account must be financed. South Africa has been able to attract further financial inflows from abroad to finance the difference. So even if we have seen this net sales in the recent past by residents, South Africa continues to attract inflows to finance the current account deficit. And if this picture continues like that, we could face a possible sovereign rating downgrade, which will impact on the cost of the cost of financing. So it's a picture that we have to continue to watch very closely. On the domestic front, the inflation environment is a challenge for monetary policy, with rising headline and core inflation, although there seems to be relief now coming from the oil prices, because the oil prices now is adjusted from around 108 to just below $90 a barrel. The only thing is that there has been compensatory effect. The oil price has come down, the rent has depreciated, but our calculation at the moment is that there is an over recovery on the petrol price, and motorists should experience a reduction in the oil price when the next adjustment, in the petrol price when the next adjustment another element of the inflation picture, however, is that lower crop prices are expected to moderate food price inflation. So we are going to be watching a combination of what happens with food prices and what happens with the petrol price, because both and the exchange rate, the combination of those three factors are going to have a significant, are going to be the significant drivers of inflation over the next over the medium term. The pressure, as indicated, the pressure from the oil prices have moderated recently. Agricultural price, though, remain above the upper end of the target range. We such SA compiles this administered price index, which includes the petrol price and also electricity. The red line is the administered price excluding the overall administered price. As you can see, it's still above the inflation, the targeted inflation rate. And if you adjust it for petrol, which is the green line, you can see it's slightly above. But if you exclude both petrol and electricity, we are then at the top of our target range, which does explain what I was saying to you, that the combination of petrol price, exchange rate, and food is what is going to be driving the inflation going forward. In terms of our own forecast, 2014 we expect inflation to average 6.2% with a peak of 6.5%, which we think took place in the second quarter of this year. We expect to be back within the target in the first quarter of next year, and that in 2015 we would average 5.7 and 5.8 in 2015. And monetary policy has responded to higher inflation pressure, but has also been sensitive to the real economy, with the real repo rate only being slightly positive. And actually, based on projected inflation, you can actually say that it is mildly negative. At this stage, then, I would like to hand over to Nadeem to take you through the group annual financial statement, and then once she is done, I will then deal with the questions that were raised by the PDO.
It has an independent board appointed by the Minister of Finance, and surplus profits after considerations in terms of what we want to keep in reserve are then transferred to government. South African Banknote Company, well, that's the banknotes that you use every day, that's the company that produces the banknotes. It is registered in terms of the Companies Act, and it also has an independent board and subcommittee. We have the South African Mint that makes all your coins that you use, also a company registered in terms of the Companies Act, and it has an independent board and subcommittee. And then we have the South African Reserve Bank Captive Insurance Company, SALTIC, and that's registered in terms of the Companies Act as a public company. SALTIC carries out the short-term insurance business for the bank and its subsidiaries, and it has an independent board and subcommittee. On to the highlights for 2014, and as you've well heard that the Deputy Governor has talked about the rand depreciation, and in essence, the biggest part of our balance sheet, the biggest asset on our balance sheet is our foreign reserves. And on the liability side, there's a huge liability called the Golden Foreign Exchange Contingency Reserve Account, and that's where you've really seen the growth of the liability. So when we look at the rand, it's depreciated against major currencies, and if we look specifically at the dollar, the rand has depreciated over the year. From the previous year, we were sitting at 9.20, and as at 2/13/2014, we were at 10.58. So quite a significant depreciation, which does impact the value of your assets, our foreign reserves on the balance sheet, as well as that gold and foreign exchange contingency reserve account on the liability side, and that's why that has grown. So that was offset partly by the gold price, which decreased to 13,687 rand per fine ounce from 14,742 in 2013. So slightly decreasing our gold reserves, and our gold holdings increased by 1,192 fine ounces. The Steve Williams, this is a 60% subsidiary of the SA Mint. This was new, and we the SA Mint consolidated for the first time in the current year, 18 months of the results of Steve Bullion. And effectively, it resulted in a profit for the group of 92 million and a non-controlling interest attributable to Rand Refinery of 89 million. And that can be seen on page 36 in your annual report. Effectively, the Steve Bullion was an incorporated JV between the SA Mint and Rand Refinery Pty Limited, which manufactures, sells, and distributes William Kruger coins in both local and international markets. And the SA Mint, as I mentioned, holds 60%. I'm not going to spend too much time on this in terms of the summarized financials. And the Deputy Governor has touched on integrated reporting, that as a central bank, I couldn't really find any other central bank to benchmark against. And in fact, our auditors, when we had to produce a summarized set of financials, and I said to our auditors, can they please produce an audit opinion for my summarized? They said to me, sure, Nadine, you're pioneering. Even when they touched base with the London office didn't really have something to give me guidance on, so we developed this from scratch. And quite a few central banks, as the Deputy Governor is saying, is they're beginning to look at it, and they're touching base with their auditors because they also want to start doing something similar to what we're doing in terms of a summarized set of financials. You'll see with your JSE listed companies, they started integrated reporting in 2012, and they also have what we call interim financial statements, also a summarized set. But that's obviously for listed companies, and we're not a listed company. So effectively, only material balances and notes have been disclosed in the summarized, together with a full disclosure on accounting policy. And as I mentioned, we have an auditor's opinion, director's report, and report of the audit committee is also included, and the financial framework. These details of the 14 framework of the summarized financial statements. But what we're saying is there is a full set of annual financials which is available on our web, and we do encourage everyone to refer to that because it has all the details. Statement of comprehensive income is the effect of the income statement. From a group perspective, you can see that net interest income basically has increased by 86 million from the prior year. And then if we look at operating costs specifically, that has increased operating cost line from 3.9 billion to 4.685 billion from the group perspective. And that's an increase of 775 million from last year. And the key contributors are personnel costs, increased by 288 million for the staff, 46 million for the subsidiaries, and effectively we had some restatements, but that was more around new accounting standards and reclassification of financial information, which actually offset against that. The cost of new currency, if you recall, we launched the Mandela series in November 2012. Here we have got a full year of having the currency, and obviously we had greater volumes in the current financial year, and therefore that was up 110 million. And then other operating costs, that was really, you know, most of it was around illegal deposit taking schemes, Ponzi scheme awareness program. So a lot of it, that's what goes into the operating cost line, as well as repairs and maintenance, licensing fees from your IT side. So a lot of that goes into there. And then 359 million for the subsidiaries. The bulk of it being the SA banknote, because of obviously ramping up production in terms of the Mandela series. And then also, with Prestige Bullion coming into the picture, as much as you get the extra income, you also have the extra expenses from an operating perspective. From the group results perspective, this is just to show you what the subsidiaries have contributed. Obviously, the Saab has a loss of 1.6 billion. And you can see that's just halfway down. And the subsidiaries, the CPB SMH, SA Banknote, and Saab Kick have contributed 289 million, which gives us a group loss after taxation of 1.3 billion. And if you take off the non-controlling interest, that's the bit that's ratified, we have the 40% in Prestige Bullion, that leaves you with a total loss attributable to the parent of 1.4 billion. The statement of financial position, that's your balance sheet. As you can see, as I mentioned, total assets have grown from the group perspective by 68.9 billion, and most of that related to effectively the depreciation of the rand against major currencies, as well as slightly offset by, as I said earlier on, in terms of the gold price decrease. And then total liabilities, that has also grown, and that's mainly, as I said to you, the gold and foreign exchange contingency reserve account, that's the JFECRA. That has grown due to the depreciation of the rand against the major currencies. And deposit accounts also increased by 13.3 billion, and likewise foreign loans and deposits increased by 4 billion. Now, the JFECRA is an unusual account because, in terms of the Saab Act, all FX gains and losses, whether they're realized or unrealized, so from the depreciation of the rand against the other currencies, that all goes into this balance sheet account called the JFECRA. Now, if we had to do normal accounting in terms of the accounting standards, those gains and losses should go through your P&L. That's what would happen with every other company. But because our Saab Act says we have to, the forex gains and losses are for the account of government, we accumulated in this JFECRA account. So it's an unusual accounting treatment, but because of the Saab Act. And then our total capital reserves is now sitting at 6.3 billion versus last year. Now, as you can see, the contingent reserve, and that was raised earlier on, that decreased by 1.6 billion, and effectively the overall loss is offset against that contingency reserve account, and that's why it's reduced to 4.7 billion. And that deals with what I have to cover. I hand back.
I start to still confuse the market to say that we have a somewhat improved global growth picture in the second quarter of 2014, but there are risks that are emerging, and the risks to the growth outlook are on the downside. We've seen a weak economic growth outlook for South Africa, and that the inflation remains above target with upside risk, resulting in a moderate tightening cycle that we have seen already in January this year. But we expect that the inflation rate will come back into target in the first quarter of 2015. Monetary policy will continue to focus on our inflation mandate, but be sensitive to the state of the real economy. And that given the global and domestic economic context and the expanded mandate, the financial situation continues to be challenging. So that is what we have for you, and with your permission, Chair, I can then go and deal with the questions that were raised by the CEO. And the point that was raised about the six focus areas of Benjamin, if you look back on the previous report, you will find that they were not even captured in the fund. You have to scrape through the report to try and find them. So this was the first time that we began to flesh them out. Going forward, I mean, we will refine them. And we welcome the comments that have been made that you needed to see more performance information, and we will be able to flesh that out. It's much easier for us to spell out the performance information with respect to our primary mandate of price stability. There is one target, there is a measure, you can see how we perform against that measure. That's clear. The financial stability mandate is going to be a little bit complex, because you are going to have to employ a multiplicity of tools, and you are looking at all sorts of things. And all central banks, when we talk to the other central banks, they say to us, what makes you think you are so special? We are all trying to grapple with the same thing, and hopefully we will figure it out at the central banking community. But the comments are spot on, and we welcome that, and we will make sure that we work on it. On the debt to equity ratio that has increased, it's not a very useful one, that one. Nadine has touched on the gold and foreign exchange contingency reserve account, the GFEC. That is the biggest liability on the balance sheet of the bank. But for all intents and purposes, it's what the central bank owes to the South African taxpayers, so to say. The authors of the SAP Act wanted to protect the bank against the volatility of the exchange rate and created this account. And for those who have been in this committee before, you might be aware that prior to 2002, that account used to be a big asset on the books of the South African Reserve Bank. And the National Treasury has to settle that annually with government bonds. An arrangement was reached after the Auditor General was asked by the National Treasury to audit the GFEC and what goes into the GFEC. After that audit, the Auditor General said that there needs to be spelled out a mechanism between the National Treasury and the Reserve Bank on how to deal with the profits and losses that emanate from that account. And an agreement that was reached was that all the things that have losses or profits that have money market effect would then have to be settled between the two institutions. And those that do not have the money market effect will be kept on the balance sheet of the Reserve Bank as per the Act, so that when there are fluctuations in the exchange rate, you don't have to go back to the fiscal asking for a recapitalization and so forth. And that is how it was done. The other central banks take that directly into the profit and loss statement. The thing about central bank accounting is that every central bank accounts differently, accounts according to its own act. So you will see in our report that we will say that we are reporting against according to international financial reporting standards, but here are the exceptions. Where our act spells differently, we will account according to that act. So calculating the debt to equity ratio for the South African Reserve Bank, taking account of the GFEC, is not a very useful calculation to make. The reduction in the contingency that I think NID has dealt with that, if the Reserve Bank makes losses, those losses would have to be offset against the contingent reserve. That is exactly why the contingent reserve was created. It was created for this thing. And how does the central bank make a loss if its job is to print money? Well, the reason is a very simple one. We have got assets, and our assets are the foreign exchange, the gold and foreign exchange reserve that we hold on behalf of the country. When we earn interest on both reserves, that interest is for the account of the reserve bank. And that is what we would use. Global interest rate has declined so significantly that what we earn from both reserves is so minuscule. It's minuscule. So when you then look back, when we acquire the reserves, we will use rents to acquire the reserves, which means that we are putting rents into the South African economy. What that does is that it creates money. So you might end up with a situation where too much money is chasing very few goods, and that is when inflation begins to rear its ugly head. So what central banks then do is that we sterilize those flows, which means that after we have bought the foreign exchange reserve, we will then use either the repo or we will use government bonds through what's called open market operations to mop up the liquidity. Finally, South African government bond yields are at around 8.6%. The reserves are earning about 1 or 2%. So the loss comes from that differential in the interest rate from what we earn and what it costs us to mop the liquidity in the domestic situation. Of course, we could have decided not to do it and say that we must protect the profitability of the SAR. Well, the last time I read the Constitution, it said, our responsibility is to protect the value of the currency in the interest of balanced and sustainable growth. It didn't say you must profit in the interest of balanced and sustainable growth. So we are living up to our mandate and hence that law. The taxpayers are not making a loss because, as you said, we are making a profit on, big profit on the G-Vector, but that is not for the account of the reserve bank, it's for the account of the on the HR side, yes, the turnover, we've got a low staff turnover, but that is a plus and it's also a negative. It's a plus because it means we have got this continuous group of these skilled people that we all, and experienced people that we always have access to. It's a minus in the sense that it makes it difficult to inject new blood and have a continuous renewal of the institution. The plus side, though, is that the next 5 to 7 years offers an immense opportunity for the reserve bank because there are there is a significant number of people who would be reaching retirement age. And our HR function has done was to work a workforce, do a workforce plan to say, in expectation of all this retirement, what competencies, what skills should we build over the next 5 to 7 years to make sure that when these people eventually retire, we have got a core of talent that will continue to and make sure that we are able to execute on our mandate. Unless I have missed anything, those are the questions that have come from the people.
Thank you, Governor. Over to the committee members. Yes. I can't see everybody giving the way. Why don't I just sit there? I've got to make notes now. If I don't catch you, then you'll alert me to it. Right? So you know your sequence. If Susak, Fongiles, Dion, David, is there a hand beyond that? There's Tandy. Okay. And then we come back to catch you. Why don't we just go down this route? That doesn't make any difference. Right. Starting from here. Here we are.
Thank you, Chair. Let me start by welcoming the presentation and the input also from the PBO. Chair, on the economic outlook, I've noticed with interest how an analysis of the European zone was conducted. I've realized that it is my application is correct, I've realized that you are excluding Germany's performance out of the European zone. I'm not sure what is the impact of that to your final analysis, because I'm of the opinion that the interdependence of the economies in those zones is something that is very critical to be considered. So I'm not sure if we single out Germany out of the whole zone, I mean, how does that affect the final analysis? And on the, you know, listening to this presentation, one might easily conclude that it's all good. And I'm so obsessed of solution. What is it that we need to do? I appreciate your monetary intervention in as far as the repo rate determination is concerned. But what are other options in as far as monetary and fiscal policy is concerned? What is it that can be done better? And I also appreciate that most of the factors cited as impediments here are exogenous factors. But in terms of internally, those endogenous factors, I mean, what is it that you need to be brought to our attention? I mean, that will need our focus going forward. And also, Chair, the issue of our debt ratio to GDP. Look, we are committing to big infrastructure projects. That's the thing, because we want to develop. Now, there is this concern that we are very, very cautious as to how we increase, I mean, our rate of acquiring debt. Now, I just wanted to check I found it very interesting how your staff recognize you and how our chairs recognize you. He's recognized you as a governor. He recognized you as a deputy governor. So that's a very technical, which I appreciate, because I know that effectively you are starting from the 1st of November, you know, which was a very good, what you call it, an interesting observation. But now, what I'm trying to establish on this one here is, do we have enough space, I mean, to get into the debt and get money to invest into our infrastructure projects, you know? Or maybe are we at a rate where we need to say, no, hold on, I mean, we don't need to go beyond where we are now. And the last thing, I think that's something that we raised during our other visit to your institution, that the workforce plan, we haven't received yet. We really want to pay attention to details, because one of the concerns that we raised during our visit is the issue of gender in the composition of the management team. And I think we all agree that we're not doing well in that regard. So I think it's important if we can be finished with that workforce plan as a committee, so as going forward we are able to pay our attention to these details. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Let me also welcome the presentation. I think Comrade Dev has touched on the issue of the intervention. But there's one interesting slide that I saw that speaks about large contractions where you also include construction. That's one of the areas where construction are listed. It's mining, it's trade, it's construction, and I can't remember the fourth one. And I'm not sure what do you think is the reason for that to categorize it as one of the sectors that are affected by construction, because I had thought it was one of the elements that we thought should be used to mitigate on the economy that was affected, at least since the economic downturn. And as South Africa, we thought construction can be one of those areas that we focus on. to mitigate on our situation. Thank you.
Thank you very much to our chairperson and to this input that we had. Very interesting input. May I first start off by the very first slide, I think it's on the second page, where it stated that the type of reporting which is now being implemented is this integrated reporting. It is actually uploaded. The beautiful type of reporting, and we do take note that even other countries are taking note of how far we have advanced when it comes to integrated reporting. The second matter which I would like to talk about is the matter where it was said that I think in a lot of families, or in most families, we are seeing people spending less. They are spending less because of the unemployment, the lack of funds, and everything else. How much of this is taken down to the relevant quarters to actually try and address this? Because some of the matters may not be directly addressed by yourself, but you have a right to actually approach a particular sector and actually inform them that as SARS. I think it was with slide. I've just forgotten which one that I will go through, where there was the description of this type of a situation where people are spending less. What actually happened? And the issue of, I think we call it mechanization, it's also an issue where I noted the governor saying that probably for safety reasons, that's why we tend to have quite a lot of this. It is quite true, but it also has an effect on creating unemployment on our people. What recommendations have you actually taken forth to the relevant quarters to ensure that we really try and turn this around? Because yes, it's quite true, mechanization is needed, it's got safety standards, but it also drives people away from their employment, so that in the end you get people staying in their homes because they are unemployed, so they spend less. So it's basically a vicious cycle. How do you recommend we actually break into that? I can see that slide now is on page 12, where we said very little for people to spend on. No money, of course, then you've got nothing to buy with. The last point which I wanted to address is the last slide. The last slide, I think one of my colleagues also spoke about it, is on these emerging risks. How do we actually try and address these major risks head on so that we can see a difference in the weak economy, inflation above target, monetary policy, and everything else? Exactly what is going to be needed to be done, not only by yourself, but only by us as well, as a committee, so that we don't just listen to you, but you come up with proposals facing, saying to us, we would like you as a committee to assist us to address these emerging risks or to address these risks in this way, in that way, in that way. That is exactly what we need. How can we work together to make a difference? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chairperson. I'd like to also add to my colleague's congratulations for the incoming governor. Well done on your appointment. We look forward to working. My understanding is that as we have mentioned earlier on, is that the existing governor's term, was to end in early November. Now, obviously, your appointment has been made, and it's been a fairly quick transition. And I was just wondering a bit about that. I know that there was some surprise expressed in the marketplace, which was amazing to me, but the fact is that there was some surprise that it was quite a rapid transition. And I just wanted to know whether that was sort of a design by the bank to make sure that the transition was quick and smooth. So I'd like some comments on that. Then there was this issue of shareholders who were a little bit uncomfortable a couple of years ago, and they were then driving towards, pressing towards nationalization of the bank for their own personal selfish needs and gain. And we then subsequently changed the law, etc. And I'm just wondering whether this is now, this matter is now finalized, and if not, then how is it being managed, because it isn't a good situation to have hanging around. And then there has been mention about the significant negative sentiment regarding our economy. And that, of course, is very, very troubling to everybody in the country. There is no doubt about that. I'm just wondering, what is the bank doing to manage, or it's very hard to do, I know that, and we don't have much control over that, but what is the bank doing to improve the perceptions amongst investors about our economy within, obviously, the capabilities that you have? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson, and may I also join my colleagues in congratulating the Governor General on his appointment. Thank you very much. In terms of your conclusions, you've mentioned that that you will be very sensitive to the state of the real economy, and I think that's much appreciated. Can I then make the assumption that the main challenge would be for us in this space is to maintain our fiscal space that we have, in terms of stopping the widening deficits, trying to get the economy growing, and in fact addressing the very serious issue of administered prices. And that's where my question comes in with regards to your focus in terms of inflation-related targets. Now, we've seen over 6 years that we had far above inflation-related electricity increases. And we saw this year another 5% from Eskom granted, from NERSA granted to Eskom, which will give us 13% increase again in the next year. Then we also have the nuclear announcements, which somehow needs to be funded. And my opinion is that that will plunge the South African consumers into poverty and massive debt. And I see from your presentation that households' debt remain very high, and that the growth in households' consumption, we see a declining trend in terms of that. And what would your views be on, and I think one of my colleagues mentioned the value of huge infrastructure projects. What would your views be if there's a recommendation that we should allow private sector to build and money manage these infrastructure projects? In the budget in February, the then Minister of Finance said that privatization is an outdated concept. And then later we saw a complete turnaround in terms of government acknowledging that the private sector should be central to this position. Just in terms of growth then, in terms of our structural constraints, many analysts says that it's self-inflicted, and that we see a continuous downward trend in terms of growth, as you also mentioned. I just note that in terms of the international economic growth within the BRICS countries, that India, as the big anchor within the BRICS countries, being the world's largest democracy, noted, especially Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister, the promise to renew business and investor confidence, and his proposal to less reliance on the state, which was also linked perhaps to the privatization issue that I think should be placed more central to the economy, more liberalization of labor laws, less protectionism, and better competitiveness. I would appreciate your views on those issues.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. We welcome the new governor, Professor Sotuwansi Mokgoro from North. There was a smooth transition from the previous governor to the new governor, because there's no policy shift. Therefore, I don't think investors should be worried, because there's no policy shift at all. The uncertainty with the announcement of this. So maybe we as politicians always need that type of assurance on a regular basis that there won't be policy shift. There's always that people seeking assurance whether are we intent. tending to take more radical positions. Of course, I've seen the repo rate going for 25 basis points. There are those who envisage that 100% basis points. So on a regular basis, we need to engage to understand that we're not intending to loosen any monetary policy. But we've got competing demands, and that's what we need to clarify. I know the governor does not necessarily have to get in the political space, as what we always want to see. The competing demands are in such that we need to address economic growth and employment creation. It's a very complex environment of a country that needs to create employment and also to make sure that the economy at the same time grow. So the fiscal and monetary policy that we take shapes those debates in the public discourse. So the decisions that are taken are the ones that actually, as the bank, make investors to be interested. But at the same time, any bank will want to have reserves for the rainy days. So it's a very complex matter. And I'm happy that you clarified this today in this meeting to say that there's a clear constitutional mandate in what we want to achieve. It's not going to be profit-making at the expense of development. It's a fact. And it's a fact that many of us need to start to grapple with. Of course, there are different opinions out there about, some may say, oh, this is a neoliberal decision taken by putting this person. Actually, the ACL government has been very clear on its fiscal and monetary policy. It has never favored one policy above and the other. It has always struck a balance in this context. But one thing, government, that interests me, and it's a very simple matter, because I can go to town with this, you know, I've engaged on this matter, I can speak the whole day on it. The issue is, other countries buy people to stay longer, the specialized skills in special occupations, and we have not paid much attention to it. They buy them to stay in their jobs. The other day I asked the governor whether we should be interested to be part of the rating agencies, and she said never. She used the word never. You know, I wish she could, so that we can shift the thinking, so that they can be competing thinking on how rating agencies look at countries and investments and everything else, so that when there are different opinions, we can be able to weigh in. Because you see, in economics, there's no wrong or right. You always try something that can work. At that particular conjuncture, if it does not work, you move to the other. So you don't have to be conservative about that, your ideas all the time. But how you come across, I don't know whether it's because of the media people, how they put it and coin it in their newspapers, I don't know, but it creates this impression. So we've been doing well, and nobody says it out loud. Maybe we should blow our own horn. So I'm interested to know the strategies that you want to implement in this attention, but not at the expense of transformation. You know why I say that? I want, well, of course, fortunately we had a female governor now, and fortunately we have a younger governor for a change, you know, in the world of this fiscal environment. I was telling Elisa here that in fact in the world we've got younger presidents, most of them are less than 50 years of age, especially in Scandinavian countries. So in South Africa, we still go for people who are also injured. I'm not saying I'm going for the government, but oh my word, I should not be charmed for what I said. So, how do we curb this leakage in the skills without necessarily compromising transformation and seeing at the end that we adjust the geographic spreads of our country, but also everybody will be looking at you, at your approach, and say, what is it that is giving you? So maybe some words today that says this to bolster the South African development and the perceptive mind that sees it as if there's more government intervention. There's those that believe in trade liberalization. where there might be government intervention. I don't know why it has worked successfully and to the benefit of the poor. Of course, we don't want a government that is too interventionist in approach at the expense of economic growth, but we need to strike a balance. So that word is needed at this conjuncture to say this is how we're going to bolster economic growth in this environment that we find ourselves in, where some already are saying we're going towards stagflation when it's not actually, it's not even closer to that. So basically that's very important.
The other please consider that.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, honorable member, and honorable government, and delegation from the Reserve Bank colleagues. Chair, just one thing that I thought would maybe come up from the presentation that is in the bank supervision department's annual report, which, and it relates to credit risk. I think the governor has indicated the issues of risk in terms of households and companies, but the bank supervision report indicates that in terms of the what they call like credit risk measures, the loss given default and probability of default, that's the one thing. The banks get different results as a result of different methodologies, but it also seems from the wording of the report that there's also an issue about, and the wording is that expert judgment in the modeling process also determines the results that banks get. Wording such as that in different areas of the report indicates, makes you wonder about how the banking industry is doing in terms of the management of banks, because there has been supervisory intervention in some banks. And that also relates to the market risk aspect, where certain banks have, and we don't see from the report which banks these are. I think that maybe the bank could tell us what challenges, certain banks have challenges with both regulatory environments and the international environment, the local and international. But this also relates to how banks conduct business. So there seems to be a need to look closely into the banking industry and what the health of the South African banking industry is. A little bit of unpacking, the report would just say the banking sector faces certain challenges. What are those challenges specifically now that the Reserve Bank is here, and in areas where the bank supervision department has had to intervene, especially maybe just to give the committee a broad picture of how our banking sector is doing, if there's any areas of concern or intervention, and also areas where the banking supervision department has intervened. What were the challenges there, and are there other issues that the committee should be aware of? Thank you, Chair.
Anybody else who's asking? No. Especially. I think that in our report to Parliament, I'm saying I think, you know, see, remember when I say these things, they're just my views. Clearly, we will sit as a collective and look at a draft report and collectively decide what the committee thinks. So if for some reason they disagree with me, I actually don't care. Because I'm simply saying that this is something the committee drafters should actually consider. write something about in the report about this integrated reporting, which we're leading the world in, from what I can gather, and others have congratulated you, to write something about it, and then the committee will decide how to go to the final draft, okay? So it's something we should consider. Where there are things that we do achieve. I mean, in this area, for example, yesterday we established, it's wonderful these things, you know, I don't know if the PEO picked it up, but SARS, when we asked them about the turnaround times, you know, I'm told we're one or number two in the world, okay? We remain one, you also contributed, obviously, in your previous role, towards being one of the world's probably best or second best in financial transparency and information. Then you get the independent regulatory board for auditors, that's the auditors, number one in the world. I mean, it's remarkable, actually. We're better than Germany and the US and Sweden and whatever, and Japan, and it's wonderful, really. Which is not to say we don't have our challenges, but you've actually yourself openly admitted to and said, look, we are in trouble and we need to do things about it, which brings me to a few things. One is, those are things I wanted to ask have been covered very adequately by my colleagues in Congress here. There are, obviously, given the sense in which you're independent, and given the limited mandate you have, and given that you cannot play too much into broad policy issues, you will answer the question as you see fit, right? I mean, I don't know where the line, so the boundaries begin and end, right? So, maybe my question is inappropriate, which gives you free to say no, unless the research is correct, no. Or that the secretary say no, it's not correct, the current bank governor should answer the problem. Unless that happens, I take it that where you say you can't answer, it's not appropriate to do so, fine. The first thing is, obviously, we as Parliament, we judge all the entities, how independent you are, and the nature of your independence, according to the predetermined, so to speak, objectives you set for yourself, as you may know. I mean, you yourself, finance when you're there, as a CFMA and MFMA put to us, warned one of the things that we decided we should do as Parliament. So the point is, I think what you say makes sense to me, that on financial stability, what precise goals or targets can you have, given the complexity of the area, right? So then they build, because we judge all entities against the performance objectives they set for themselves, presumably there's some sense in which is an obligation on you to convey that, look, it's not like saying, I'm going to deliver 300,000 housing units, and then Parliament says, but you only delivered 260,000. What happened? You know, why did you achieve your target? So it's for you to also explain the complexity of having performance targets and shape your performance targets according to the complexity and, let's say, difficulty you have in the precise target, so that we can judge you against a more general target. Secondly, you yourself said that, look, there are structural issues that need to be addressed, right, in the economy. Now, presumably, this is a task of the Minister of Finance and Parliament and the governing party and whoever else. But there may be something you might want to say about it. The third is covered also. You raised this thing about, in a way, about the private sector. I think David raised that. What can be done to ensure, but to facilitate or nudge or cajole or goad, I don't know what the word is, the private sector to invest and, create jobs. Then there's something I keep asking, and, the more I listen to people, the less convinced I am about the meaningfulness of the term. You see the thing about unemployment. It is said we have two terms. One is those who are actively seeking employment and can't find it, and those who've given up. And then we use as official figure the former. Frankly, governor or governor to be, governor designate, whatever the term is. I don't know why it's getting so technical. I mean, you see, it's so improving. I don't think Jill Marcus is going to get deeply upset. But anyway, just before Des corrects me, governor designate, right? What I'm asking is, what is the meaning of the former category? In fact, it's worse that there are people who have given up. They are more unemployed in a philosophical sense than those who are seeking jobs. So where does this come from? Is it something in economics, or is it meaningless thing? To a politician, it's utterly meaningless, right? The real figure is like denialism, you know? 36%, 38% of the people are unemployed. What does it matter that as a technical figure, who cares that 24% only are unemployed? It doesn't help to shape policies towards growth and job creation. But perhaps you answer, ask this question before people laugh. And they sort of grudgingly acknowledge it's really not a useful term. Is this part of the lexicon or the terms of economic and finances internationally, we can't get away from it. I just think it's an utterly... Look, I'm a sociologist by training, so you might say I'm stupid. It's fine. But as a sociologist, really, we care about people. It doesn't really matter to us, oh, you know, the employment is... Then Kosati will say, it's 40%. Governments will say, no, they're wrong. It's 26% and all that. It's actually, whoever is unemployed is unemployed. What does it matter? Okay, then the loss you've covered, I didn't understand it, but you gave a very good answer. Well, it's accurate or not, I can't say. I must think about this, I don't know enough, but it sounds compelling to me. I would like a bit more about, you know, what you project. Look, I get a sense, right, being governor, my source of economic life is the business day, okay? So I read the Business Day very keenly, which I've been doing for 20+ years. I think it's the best newspaper, by the way, from this colleague. Not just because it covers the state of the finance, you know, it's opinion writing, you know, amongst the best as a whole, right? What I want to ask you is, the sense I get is that there's huge amount of investment, right? And there isn't like any glimmer of light on the horizon. And I really think this opening, that I saw your figures, you know, that you compared to 2009 and so on, but it seems to me that something more has to be done to assist people out there with their indebtedness. Right? I don't know what it is we can do as governments, as the Reserve Bank, as political parties, as parliament, but people seem to me to be desperate out there. And then finally, I'm not sure whether this is the right terrain or the right time. But at some stage or the other, presumably the National Treasury, yourselves, and whoever else is relevant will have to appear before this committee. But where are things with the African Bank? If you can't say anything, it may not be diplomatic at this stage or technically sensitive, because there are all sorts of work that is taking place that it may not be useful to advance by publicly issuing statements right now. But at some stage, Parliament will be interested to call you and the Minister and whoever else before us. What lessons are we drawing? Are there any we can draw right now? Do you have a view at all, or is it appropriate to ask Chris? I don't know if it's not government itself, but it's in the list, you know. Do you have any views about a state bank? Right? And a cooperative bank? We've got a relationship with regard. Is it appropriate for you, or do you think these are matters that have got to be addressed by the Ministry and the DG of Treasury? Thank you indeed.
Thank you very much, Chair. I have known the 33%.
I think the governor will expect to reply finally and 10 minutes for each reply. Pick up the theme.
Okay.
And members are unhappy, they'll come back.
Okay. I think this, let me start from where you have left. The thing about financial stability mandate at the moment, and the other thing, is that you are going to have to set a multiplicity of targets in financial stability.
Yeah.
With price stability is straightforward. You pick one indicator, everybody can relate to it. And part of the problem with financial stability is that theoretically it's a new concept in the literature. Just about prior to 2008, there wasn't much that was written about financial stability. But after 2008, it has been a fair amount of literature on financial stability. Whichever way you diagnose it, there's a lot of it. Whichever way you diagnose it, when you ask, what is how do we know that we are succeeding in achieving financial stability? The definition goes something like, we know we are achieving financial stability when we don't see financial instability. So it's not a very useful thing. It's one of those things which, when you don't have it, you will know that you have it. When you do not have financial stability, you will know you do not have it. And the consequences are remarkable. So one of the emerging definitions, though, since the last time I had seen it, is that it's defined as that state when markets continue to function, the financial system continues to function, and credit is flowing to the areas where it is supposed to flow to. Right? So that there are some working things that is related. But we will be facing this thing. probably before the end of this year, we would publish a discussion document at the draft level, which then say, this is our take on financial stability. These are the tools we think we need with respect to financial stability. And if we are faced with instability, these are the tools we will deploy in this area, these are the tools we will deploy in this area, so that there could then be a meaningful public discourse on financial stability. The issue of the economy and the what are the structures, I think that I was linking to what was said, what can fiscal and monetary policy do? Truth of the matter is that fiscal and monetary policy, as soon as South Africa got into recession, late 2008, early 2009, did what was supposed to be done. We acted counter-cyclically. Monetary policy provided accommodation, and fiscal policy created a stimulus. Now you can continue with that for as long as you have what the fiscal space. And once the fiscal space gets, so how do you know your fiscal space is getting close? Is when your debt to GDP ratio rises and your fiscal deficit is remaining elevated, and you realize that you have now come to the time where you need fiscal consolidation. You know you no longer have the space that you have. How do you know you no longer have the space for monetary accommodation? It's when you realize the economy is not quite picking up, inflation is creeping out of its target range, and that your credibility is starting to be questioned as to whether you would be able to raise inflation in the future. And you do not want to act at that time, because if you act at that time, then we are back to 1998, where the reaction of monetary policy would be so high, raised by 200 basis points and so forth. Fortunately, we are not there. And that is why you saw that we were able to act in a very measured way, because we had the space to be able to do what we are doing. Now, monetary policy and fiscal policy affect growth in the cycle. That's why they can only act counter-cyclically. They will not change the underlying structure of the economy. To change the underlying structure of the economy, you need fundamental structural reform. With macro policies, getting to stabilization is easy. There are two authorities on macroeconomic policy. Is the Reserve Bank on monetary policy, is the National Treasury on fiscal policy. With structural reform, it's complex. You have got all of the departments, whether it has got to do with energy, it has got to do with transport, it's got to do with agriculture, it's got to do with labor market. You are having all of those departments. It's more complex than conducting an orchestra. And if anyone understands opera, is that you have to conduct the orchestra and others are not playing along, it can produce a very terrible sound. So it is a complex matter, and fortunately for me, it is in the preserve of other instruments. But the question that I was asked was, what is it that has to be done? This economy is overanalyzed. This economy is overanalyzed. We have had the diagnostic report from the National Planning Commission. It spells out very clearly where our problems are. And the National Development Plan came and said, these are the solutions to deal with the problems that we have had. Fortunately, in the out of that, for me, they didn't say the Reserve Bank have to do the following. So we know that then we are doing the right thing, that the things that must be done to take the economy on a higher growth trajectory are actually lying elsewhere. It sounds like passing the bar, because I guess you could say to me, what did you do when you were pulling the lever? But I am no longer pulling those levers. The thing about the unemployment definition, which
you are saying good for them. The
definition of unemployment. Unfortunately, this thing gets defined, and you ask whether it is an economic concept. And unfortunately, is not quite an economic concept. It's a statistical concept. And I'm sure the statistician general is coming here in terms of tomorrow. You can ask him that question. Because if the definition, they meet as the statistician globally, and they coin this definition so that they can compare across the world. But I am also
back once again, I think.
But I am told that the International Labour Organization was also involved in that definition. There were the issues of the level of indebtedness that we, how we can assist people. I think in looking at the thing of the indebtedness, there are three issues. The first one is a financial stability stroke macro issue, where we would measure the levels of indebtedness, not just for the household sector. We would look at what is the indebtedness of the household sector, the corporate sector, and government, and say, how does that look relative to the size of the economy? And whether it is too big to the point where it justifies policy action, that is one aspect. One the thing that the second aspect has to do with, do the level of indebtedness pose a threat to the financial system? In which case we will take and analyze banks and say, are the banks giving out too much credit too easily? If that is the source of your problem, you can get there and you can impose the regulations. The banks understand it. When we come, they can see us coming and they respond appropriately. The third aspect has to do with the conduct of the credit provider. We used to have, before the National Credit Act, something where you get an SMS that says, reply with the word yes, and your credit will be approved. That clearly was not good market conduct. And the passing of the National Credit Act literally meant that they were able to nip that thing in the bud, because then we introduced the concept of reckless lending and so forth. But households being indebted, we need a different conversation. The flow of credits to households is very important for the acquisition of assets and so forth. The question is, the households are taking credit now, what do they do with the credit? And we need a different conversation. The conversation that we have to have as South Africans is this notion that says, the just next door have bought a new TV. I want a TV bigger than theirs, and I don't want it tomorrow, I want it yesterday, and I am going to borrow the money to do it. And when you do not get the access to the credit from the banks and so forth, you go to all of those other lenders outside of the banking system as the debt piles up. So when the figures of the National Credit Regulator comes out, you must understand they include credit by the bank and they include credit by the non-bank. And actually, a lot of our problems lie in the credit extended by the non-bank, mainly the micro lender. So it's a conversation that we should have as a nation. Let me just turn to your plans to group this. I'm not sure that I group them properly. Honorable Van Rooyen, the thing about why would we exclude Germany, I decided to put the slide back, but they switched off the projector. The slide, actually, why we removed Germany. It was not that we are excluding them. We broke it down. The reason we broke it down is that Germany has been the best performing economy in the euro area, and it is the largest. So if you analyze the euro area and you are including Germany, it gives a very rosy picture. It looks like the euro area is doing well. But if you take out Germany, then you can actually see that the euro area is insignificant. Trouble. So it was not that we are excluding Germany, it was so that we can understand what is happening in the rest of the euro area if you do not take account of Germany.
Isn't Germany excluding here just now?
Yes, the only thing is that it happens in this, well, they are less bad than the rest. So that's why we will then tend to. So they are slowing down, but not as much as the rest of the. Of the euro area. So Germany is the beige line, the second line that is above 100. And you can see that even if they slow down at the end, they are still above 100. The 100 here, we utilize 2008, because 2008 is when the global crisis 13. And you can see they have recovered from the pre-crisis era. Whereas the rest of the euro area, which is the blue line, you can see they are below 100. They are still below where they were in 2008. So it was for the purpose of analysis, so that you could understand how the different countries interact with each other. The issue of workforce planning and if you would like us to share with you, I don't know when would be the appropriate time. It's something that we are quite happy to do. We have these things worked out going forward, and the issue of gender representation, I have already had this question time with another one from the other. See, when I was in the treasury, when I took over from the treasury in 2004, when I appeared before this committee, they said to me, just look at you, you are leading a group of men. Where are the women? All these years, they didn't realize that the woman who was leading the team was leading a group of men. And it looks like I'm getting caught in the city. The Honorable Kekana, the issue of construction and this English, construction and contraction. What we were trying to show is that investment across the South African economy is shrinking. Not that the construction sector itself is shrinking. They are still building the roads, they are building the power stations, they are building all of this, but they too invest. So this picture here shows the growth in investment. So again, the picture could have been different, but in total, we can see that we have been growing, and then the private business enterprises, the blue line, and the red line is the total. Why the total is above zero is the contribution of the public sector that is leading. So the red line then includes the public sector. That's why we are above zero. But the private enterprises were contracting, and the big contraction was mining was not investing. The trade sector, which is basically retail and wholesale, was not investing. The construction sector, we were not expanding capacity. Part of it, when you ask and say that, is because the infrastructure sector is not growing as fast. And then the transport sector, which then leads up to the question of Honorable Rock with regard to the role of private sector in investment. And I think that you have seen that with the renewable energy project, that the private sector got involved and you saw that investment taking off significantly. And I think that when you speak to people, they will tell you that you actually need private sector involvement. I have not been in committee for a long time, so I missed some of the names. Honorable Nkomo? Yes. Honorable Nkomo, you raised the questions about mechanization and emerging risks and household spending. Household spending can only be sustained if there are household income. Household income come from increased employment. If employment is shrinking, households have got no money to spend, and household consumption expenditure is low down. I hope that I have explained that. The issue of mechanization, as I said, is a combination of factors, and we've got to change the relative prices between machines and people. If machines are cheaper and reliable than people are, companies will employ machines rather than people. And we can argue about it and make a moral argument about why we should employ more people. At the end of the day, it's going to be those relative prices. And for a country that is facing the kind of unemployment levels that we are facing, it's something we should worry about, and it's a discourse we should have as a nation to say, how do you get the employment train going? And if you have to get that employment train going, if unemployment growth comes because there is increased economic activity. So you've got to get the economy going so that there is employment Honorable George, thank you very much for your compliment on the transition to the new governor. But the compliments go to the president. He planned this, and he made sure that it is a smooth process. Yes, we did meet the fact that there was that last MPC in September. Preferably the announcement should have taken place before that. But we are grateful that the announcement took place before the term of the existing governor ended. The issue of negative sentiment and what the bank is doing about it, we see no less than 15, 20 investors a week. They come to us and we engage with them in conversation. My colleague, Deputy Governor Minele, joins roadshows with the National Treasury to go out there and speak to investors and communicate the South African investment case. He just returned last night. He was in New York and Washington, and he was carrying exactly the same thing. So we are going to carry that. But you must understand that communicating the story is one thing. You've got to be seen to be doing something at home. Then you have something to communicate. I hope I've not missed anything. Nuclear, I understand very little about nuclear physics. The issue of administered crisis is a complex one. In the administered crisis, there is petrol. Although the price of petrol is reset by the government every month, it is market-related. It takes account the oil price, the exchange rate, and the transporting of oil from wherever to South Africa. So there isn't much that you can do about that one. But there are other prices like electricity and so forth, which becomes very tricky because you've got to finance the infrastructure and you must make the choice of what the nature of that financing is. Those choices are in the fiscal space, and I understand they are tabling the MPD on the 22nd. You can ask them those questions. Shareholders, and I agree with the sentiment that has been raised, but I think I must spell out something here very important. If you buy shares in the South African Reserve Bank, you can't own more than 10,000 shares. Irrespective of how profitable the Reserve Bank is, you will never be paid more than 10 cents per share. Whatever profit is remaining goes straight to the Treasury after the bank has made some provisions for contingency reserve. The profit then goes to the Treasury. The shareholders of the bank only have a say on the appointment of 7 out of the 15 directors. The rest, the 8, are appointed by the president. So they can't control the board, they can't control policy, because policy does not lie with the board, it doesn't lie with the shareholders, policy lies with the executives, the governor and the deputy governor. So if I could figure that, what progress have we made? There are some legal processes that we are going through at the moment that I didn't want to dwell into, but we will come, I guess, down the line, we will be able to report to the committee on what we have said. I'm feeling like I should forget. There were so many of these questions, but since I have not been in committee for such a long time, I guess I must try and deal with them and see what is retaining people in the Reserve Bank becomes an important one. It's a passion of mine. I believe in building teams, but not just teams. I believe in building high-performance teams. And it's something I said to myself, that's what I would do with the Reserve Bank. Fortunately for the bank, I am building on a very strong base. The bank has a reputation, it has got the respect. I can then leverage on that respect and reputation to make sure that the bank becomes at the first port of call when young professionals who ply the trade of economics think, where do I want to ply my trade as an economist? They must think South African Reserve Bank. Yes. I think I've dealt with all of them except for Bridget's question on the bank supervision report. That report is pretty dated, because it's a report that goes up to the 31st of December 2013. We are busy with the new one. So, but this is a report that has tabled in the Congress. We had asked to come to the committee so that we can have a conversation purely on this report. And but it is now so dated that it might be useful that we wait for the updated report to be able to engage with that report. But two questions, Chairperson, that you had raised, which I will have to master sufficient diplomatic skills in dealing with them. The first one has to do with the state bank, which the predecessor of Ms. Marcus also has been talking about. I would rather not comment on it, because once that state bank is created, it's going to have to apply to us for a license. So I will not express an opinion, because then I might be accused of bias one way or the other. On African banks, I think the Minister of Finance did answer a parliamentary question, and unfortunately there hasn't been much development since then. So fine to say, and we welcome the fact that you would want to have a conversation about it. And quite frankly, it's a travesty. It's a travesty that in 2002, when we lost banks, there wasn't a parliamentary process that said, can you explain how we have lost this bank and what must be done to avoid the thing in the future? And I think that it is only proper that you say that we must come and explain it. The legally, in terms of Section 69 of the Bank Act, if we put 69A of the Bank Act, once we have put a bank under curatorship, within a period of 6 months, we should actually be presenting a report of what we think has gone wrong and what we think we have learned from that. That proves that the registrar of banks has to appoint someone outside of the bank independently, and we have appointed senior counsel advocate John Myberg, assisted by senior counsel Vincent Malika, to lead that process. That process is going on now. The supervisors are having to do presentations. The board of the African Bank individually have to make the presentation. The executive of African Bank must do presentation. And once that report is completed, I think that it should be useful in engaging with the committee. There will be a report on which we are able to engage.
All right, thank you very much. On process issues, one is the question by Ben Van Ryan about human resources, composition of your staff and so on. That can be put on paper and sent to us, say, within 10 days. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay, the breakdown. Secondly, on private sector investment, members need to be alert to the PPO having finished its work. So in our program, before the end of the year, Alan, Peter, Paul, let's see if we can't slide in a space for an input, right? On what in it is private sector investment. PBO's census report, I think it's been sent to the members. Then for the African Bank, I think it will be early in the new year that we will have the report before Parliament and National Treasury and whoever else here before us. The main point would be not just what are we doing about the African Bank, but how can we seek to prevent such occurrences? What lessons have we drawn from the experience of the African Bank, and presumably also the collapse of Sambo earlier and so on. Right. Now, unless there are major issues of follow-up or something that you asked that hasn't been responded to and you think it's desperately important, I think we should draw to a close shortly. But here I have Des with his hand up. And for you.
Thanks, Chair. I think that the German thing is fine, because I understood the rationale, because the current debate is the role of Germany in the open, the Eurozone, but also the role of other Eurozone countries in terms of supporting the dependence of Germany on those countries. Because the argument that is coming out strong is that Germany is not doing well now because it has played all along the role of other countries in terms of making it work. Mm-hmm. So that debate, I think, is going on. But I think I'm fine. I understand the rationale of separating it from the rest of the zone. The issue of, just a follow-up on the question posed by the chair, the issue of indebtedness of our people. You know, as people borrow from the banks, of course, I mean, the banks build in some risk gateway to what they are being charged or what they are being expected to pay them. So as a result of this high risk pricing, you find that most of our people end up paying a lot, and that's what we established also to do a visit to the reserve. End up paying a lot of money to the banks, more than even, I mean, what they originally borrowed, you know. So I don't know how much do you get into that space. I mean, how much are you able to ensure that risk pricing is properly regulated so as our people are not, because of risk pricing, our people end up running to these unscrupulous lenders, and that's why most of them are trapped in debt, mainly because your mainstream banks are really pricing very, very highly in terms of accommodating the risk aspects of this. Thank you.
Thank you, Benjamin. Is it on? Thank you very much, Chairperson. May I thank the Governor for his response. And probably some of the questions which we need to engage with in future is the vicious cycle that I spoke about. And where do you also refer your input to which departments? I was speaking about unemployment. Exactly where do you refer to, because it might not be your direct function. We need to try and break that cycle, and you know, we must remember the, you know, the weakest point where we need to break it. I think that is where I spoke of the unemployment as well as the very little spending that people are using in their homes because of the unemployment. So it's very important that we actually do that. Second, and I think Chairperson wouldn't mind getting that in writing, or probably at our future interaction where we can discuss that matter. The last matter which I would like to address now is the matter which was on the last slide, which was these emerging risks that we spoke about. I spoke about those emerging risks. I'm not sure as well if we can get just a synopsis today and then later in detail, because it's quite important for us to get those emerging risks. And I also further stated that what role would you like us as a committee to play with yourself in addressing this matter? Thank you very much.
David?
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the opportunity. With regards to the intervention in the African Bank, I can just commend the Reserve Bank. Thank you for the intervention. I'm quite happy that we wait for the full report before we go into depth with regards to the implications of what happened in the African Bank. But with regards to the rescue package that the Reserve Bank offered African Bank, and that is the topical issue of today, and I have so many letters from especially concerned government employment pension fund members. What was the implication in terms of the rescue package, in terms of the good bank and the bad bank? And I think the good bank gave us a 10% shade in terms of investment. But what was the role in with regards to the government employment pension fund and the PIC investment in that? And I believe it was 7 billion. But then there was also the bad bank rescue package, I assume also about 7 billion, which gives you a package of roughly 14 to 15 billion investment from the PIC that somehow seems to be the topical issue of the day, that the GEPF is involved in 15 billion in terms of the rescue package. Is it possible that you can shed some light on it? If it's difficult, we can wait for the final report. Thank you.
Okay, over to you. Sorry, you want to raise something as well, sir.
Thanks, Jeff. One issue I wanted to raise, I thought it might come up in the presentation, but so on page 19 of the printout, we've got the first slide. SARB provides forecasts of inflation for coming years, which is obviously very important for the committee from an oversight perspective. I'm aware that in the annual report, SARB provides a fan chart, which is also another area where, as the chair noted, they're very much leading in terms of central bank behavior. So the fan chart gives an indication of the likelihood of inflation being within a certain range at a particular point in time. and it might just be useful if the committee could be given some idea of the risks that exist. So how does SARB see the likelihood that inflation might be above or below the average that they've given in the slide?
Okay, that's it. If you can also round up now, I think we'll be also for the second, we're dealing with the technical stuff.
Thank you. I thought the treasurer was here to reinforce it. That's why I was inviting them to come in quickly. I don't know if I'm right, is this issue of risk pricing? Risk has to be priced. It is traded. And I know people worry about risk, but risk is very important. Because you see, an economy that does not have an appetite to take risks will never grow.
Mm-hmm.
And people invest in businesses because they are prepared to take risks. So, the only thing that I would actually is to say that because of risk pricing, people end up with a micro-lender. No, the banks are cheaper than the micro-lender. People end up with the micro-lender. Now you're saying, what are we going to be doing about it? The point here is that we regulate institutions prudentially. The issues of conduct lie with the market conduct. That is why we want to create a separate piece of market conduct. But if it is credit, the NCR gets involved. But the NCR also does not quite involve, get involved in pricing. There is the usually act, and I forgot what the usually rate is. Now, 30%. Now, there is a big debate in the economic literature as to whether putting a cap on interest rate or on any price makes sense. Because you see, what then happens is that because the usually act caps the interest rate at 30%, and the currency, the policy rate, the repo rate, is 5.75%, you go and you want to go and borrow from the micro lender, and the micro lender says, government has set the interest rate at 30%, so they lend you the money at 30%. So that's the government rate, and they lend you there's been a huge debate in the economic literature as to whether if you release that and say there is no cap, whether the price will come down. But there's also evidence that shows that when there is no cap, people charge exorbitant rates as well. So it's a complex. A matter of the pricing of credit. Check and protect.
Can you see me?
Sorry? Yeah.
Can you see
me? You want to come in on that? Dan, you want to come in on that point?
So actually, I want to protect the governor for a policy debate that should take place somewhere else. Because this thing as to at what percentage do you determine interest rates, it's not for a bank of this nature to be engaged on. It's got a bigger role to deal with. I'm being brutal, I know, in my engagement on this thing. Because this thing has been discussed at a different level where I can be accused to have been part of that life when the National Credit Act was amended. And there's unintended consequence in terms of, if you look at it from an economic point of view, there was an element of wanting to protect the consumer but at the expense of certain transactions that takes place. We need to revisit that debate at another level. So I'm just making it clear that some of the questions actually that you are throwing to the governor, that's why he called his other colleagues to at least try to take the hint of the question. Basically, honestly, Momo, I don't even know what I would attempt to do, because then we must then call DTI and call everybody else and then go back to conferences and, you know, engage. So I suggest, with due respect, that let's pack it and engage. And I was never being brutal to check on this.
Thank you very much for that brutal protection. I appreciate it. There was a question about the input of the staff. We obviously we analyze this economy. That we analyze it, we check the cycles, we analyze the facts about constraints in this economy. But we are very, very careful about where we raise this issue. We have standing committees between the bank and the national treasury. They are captured in a memorandum of understanding which was proposed with the president. And among those committees is a standing committee on macroeconomic issues. That's the channel that we would have. engaging with the Federal Reserve. There are things that we must raise. I would prefer to use that channel than take the podium and say that I have got the following issue. The emerging risks that I have to talk about, firstly on the global side, China is a big issue. At the moment, China is able to absorb commodities, South Africa exports commodities, and it's growing at 7.5%. What a problem to have. The crisis in China, when the economy starts to grow by only 7%, right? Their target is to grow at 7.5%. But whenever Chinese growth gravitates towards 7%, there are jitters in the global economy. Because this is the world's second largest economy now. So it matters. What happens to China will have implications for us. Secondly, the European Euro area is an important market for the South African manufacturers and goods. But it also becomes important because it's an important market for Chinese goods. China buys commodities from us, they produce stuff that they sell to Europe. And if Europe is not growing, we are having those kinds of problems. And lastly, is what the implication of the normalization of interest rates in the advanced economies mean for a country that is running a budget deficit and a current account deficit, if the flow starts to go in the other direction, what does it mean for the kind of stance that we take? What does it mean for monetary policy? What does it mean for fiscal policy? It's a risk that we cannot first of all, the issue of African bank and the risk and what's important. Let me again, the information I'm sharing with you is public, public knowledge. That good banks would be capitalized through an unwritten share offer by a consortium of banks to the tune of 10 billion. That underwriting means that those banks will take those shares and go and sell them to the investor so that they do not lay with the shares. PIC was owning over 15% of African banks. They saw it fit to come in and also be part of the underwrite and took half of the underwrite to protect their own investors. What then would happen is that from day one, good bank has got assets and liability that are equal. So it's a solvent, Understand that African bank is open for business. Actually, African bank has increased its deposits since curatorship and is continuing to run. The Minister of Finance was approached by the Registrar of Banks to put African banks under curatorship to prevent again contagion. African banks only make 2% of the total banking assets of South Africa, which are over 3 trillion. Only 2%. So, if deciding whether you intervene in a bank or not, the global standard is you must check how big the bank is relative to the entire banking system. Obviously, African bank is not very big. Secondly, you must then check the complexity of the bank that you are trying to resolve. And thirdly, you must check how interconnected that bank is. When we looked at African bank, it was a big. When we looked at its complexity, this is not complex. It takes money from wholesale deposits and from the capital market. It lends in the unsecured lending space. That's not looked at the complexity. And when we looked at interconnection, how is it connected with the rest of the bank? The initial analysis was that not quite connected. But for one little detail, African bank has issued bonds. Those bonds are bought by fund managers. They are in money market funds. Pension funds have invested in money market funds. And suddenly, this little institution has got this interconnected, because this tentacle running into money market funds, running into pension funds, and so forth. So we deemed it fit that we've got to interpreted. What people miss in the public discourse is that they just see the curatorship on the terms of order. Actually, the supervisory intensity was increased on African banks 18 months prior to curatorship. We had to call them in and said, your capacity is eroding, what are you going to do about it? And they said, we will go back to our shareholder. And if they did go back to their shareholder in December 2013, they managed to raise 5.5 billion from their shareholder, only for that, the whole of that money to be wiped off by losses later in the year. And when we said to them, you have lost all of that capital, what are you going to do? They said, we will go back to our shareholder. It's at that time when they went back to their shareholder for the second time that their shareholder said, this far and no further. And then they had to be placed under curatorship to prevent the risk of contagion. Now, back to good banks. Good banks, we felt that we also need liquidity. And our estimate was that it would need liquidity of some 7 billion. The South African Reserve Bank, in the ordinary course of its business, does provide liquidity to the bank. But we cannot provide liquidity unless we have got collateral. So we then said, what collateral can we have? So good bank was 10 billion, 27 billion rand worth of assets. The book that is back, that is left behind, was some 34 billion rand, if you believe the figure. Accountants got in there, we got the term of auditors, they got in there, and they said, we think that this thing is 17 billion, half of what is on the book. That is, we adjusted for non-performing loans and the
law.
And then we said, but we can't advance you 17 billion. To protect ourselves, we will only lend you 7 billion rand that is secured by this book, which you say is worth 34 billion, which our auditors say is worth 17 billion, but we will only give you 7 billion from there to protect ourselves. So the book is continuing to be collected. We will get the money. So the PIC or the GETF was not in the 7 billion. They are only in the underwriting. That's 10 billion. They are underwriting half of that. Even then, it is only provided that they are not able to have those shares being taken by private shareholders. All of this information is public information. So I start clarifying. The forecast and the franchise, I love it. We put this franchise, and if you look at those franchise, we can't meet. Right? We have created them wide enough. We can't meet. Somewhere in between lies the truth. One method is what we call the central forecast. So when you look at the franchise, you will see that there is the dark part. That is what we call the central forecast, and that's what we focus on. And that when we put a forecast, it is that central forecast. You see, forecasting is more of an art than it is a science, because there are so many assumptions that you must make, and difficult to measure people against the forecast. Don't measure us against the forecast; you must measure us against whether we have achieved the target or not. But if you want to know how well we have done with our forecast, in the first week of December, late November, we will publish the monetary policy review. The last monetary policy review of the year also makes an analysis of, this was the forecast of the Reserve Bank, this was the outcome, how have we done relative to that? And we could engage with that. Thank
is
you.
That a peer review?
We had a review of the publications of the bank that was done by a complete outsider, a professor from the University of London, that he said, can you please review our publications, and then we made changes and the improvements thereof. So we do conduct peer reviews of
it.
All right, thank you very much, Governor, to you and your team. We're very grateful for the input, and we will continue to engage as closely as we're in our time constraint. And we've been on some matters we're going to take forward. Thank you. Thank you, you call it the National Treasury. There's lunch at 1 o'clock, is that right? If you want to say
well, we would be gone by then, but yeah. Absolutely. Thank you very much. We have been dying to appear before the conversation. And the engagement is due to this
approach. Alright, if people die to appear before the conversation, if you are dying, we'll bring you here more often so you don't die. Okay, thank you very much, Treasury, over to you. You've been given a copy of their response on the textbook.
Not with Ellen, but I mean with...
No, yeah, you're right.
Maybe.
Can you answer you? Okay. Yeah.
Depends on whether the... We are all negative watching, always a worry, but this gentleman has got a better answer than that.
Watching the next one.